Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, our mission is to cut through, well, decades of forgotten history and, frankly, propaganda to explore a really explosive figure from early Mormonism.
John C. Bennett.
John C. Bennett. He wasn't just any follower, right? He was basically central to the entire project of Nauvoo.
Oh, absolutely. He was the city's first mayor. He was co-president of the church. And he was, for all intents and purposes, Joseph Smith's chief lieutenant. For a time, he was untouchable.
Until he wasn't. And the history we're getting into today, it's about a relationship that didn't just end. It detonated.
It really did. Our sources detail this incredibly public split. And it was marked by these intense, scandalous accusations. We're talking everything from alleged homosexuality to threats of assassination.
And Bennett's response was to basically try and burn the whole thing down with a national expose.
Exactly. And this is such a critical deep dive because Bennett's story, it isn't just about drama. It's about how an institution survives.
Right.
I mean, he was a deeply flawed man, a hypocrite by all accounts. But his campaign forced the early church to, you know, show its hand.
And our sources show a pretty clear pattern there.
A very clear pattern. The second Bennett challenged the prophet's authority, the smear campaigns, and, well, the threats of violence began.
Okay, so let's unpack this. Our goal here is to figure out how this incredibly close relationship turned into a blood feud and what Bennett's very dramatic exit tells us about the early years of the faith in Nauvoo.
That was a shattery time.
So the unraveling of their relationship was just immediately defined by scandal, and specifically accusations about same-sex relationships involving Bennett. To really get this, we have to understand the moral climate of the 1840s. What does the record show?
Well, historian E. Michael Quinn, his work is really foundational here. He points out that the first known instance of documented homoerotic behavior in Mormon history is tied directly to John C. Bennett.
And this wasn't just a quiet rumor.
Not at all. It became fodder for the public press. We actually have the July 1842 edition of the WASP newspaper, which was local to Nauvoo.
And they weren't subtle.
No. The paper explicitly accuses Bennett of buggery. Yeah. And in the 1840s, you have to understand, that word was both a slang and a legal term for sodomy.
So it carried extremely severe penalties. This wasn't a minor accusation.
Not in the slightest. And here's what's so fascinating. This charge, which could lead to serious criminal prosecution, is being broadcast about the mayor of Nauvoo. But
it wasn't the reason he was excommunicated.
Exactly. And that right there is the central paradox of early Nauvoo morality. When he was kicked out, the official charges were things like adultery and malpractice.
They completely sidestepped the buggery issue.
They did. Which suggests that for the leadership, you know, a public sexual scandal was bad, but challenging Joseph Smith's authority, that was the ultimate crime. The moral landscape was, let's say, conditional.
Let's stick with that idea of conditional morality. You mentioned Joseph Smith himself seems to kind of dance around the topic.
He does, and this is where his actions get very suggestive. There was this confrontation he had with Apostle Orson Pratt.
Right.
And Smith asks Pratt if he knew of any immoral acts towards the female sex or in any other way.
Or in any other way.
Yeah.
Why that phrasing?
Well, given that the WASP had already made the charge against Bennett public, historian Quinn interprets that little addition as a veiled challenge. It was almost a dare for Pratt to accuse Smith himself of sodomy.
And what did Pratt do?
He declined to answer the general question. He wouldn't charge Smith, but, and this is the key part, he also refused to exonerate him.
That silence speaks volumes.
It really does. It paints a picture of this incredibly tense, secretive environment.
Okay, so if the initial accusations were sort of tolerated, the later details seem purely strategic. Let's talk about the Francis Higbee incident.
Right. Smith later claimed he found Bennett with Higbee in a situation he described as too indelicate for the public eye or ear.
But the timing here is everything.
Exactly. This testimony only comes out in 1844. That's 2 years after Bennett was expelled and had become Smith's most dangerous public enemy.
So why bring it up then?
It's political warfare. The church newspaper, the Times and Seasons, censored the specific details, but still called the conduct revolting, corrupt, and disgusting.
So Smith is facing his own legal battles at this point.
He is. And by resurrecting these allegations against his chief whistleblower, especially one as socially toxic as sodomy, the church could effectively discredit everything else Bennett was saying about corruption and polygamy.
It's a classic character assassination. discredit the source, dismiss the message.
Precisely. The system wasn't rejecting these acts based on some fixed moral code. It was rejecting the person when they became a political liability.
Which brings us back to the philosophical justification Smith had been building in Nauvoo.
Yes, he had already laid the groundwork for this kind of ethical flexibility. Back in November 1841, he taught a doctrine that was the ultimate escape clause.
What was it?
He basically said, if you follow the revelations given through me, and if you will not accuse me, I will not accuse you, then...
What many people call sin is not sin.
Exactly. It's a terrifyingly powerful justification.
It turns morality into a loyalty test.
It does. Right and wrong become conditional, and they flow directly through Joseph Smith. This is the doctrine that justified the secrecy around polygamy, and it could also be used to kind of, you know, look the other way on Bennett's private life.
As long as he stayed loyal.
As long as he stayed loyal and quiet. He even reframed the destruction of Sodom. He taught it wasn't about same-sex relations, but about rejecting prophets and not being hospitable.
Citing the book of Ezekiel to do it.
Right. He was redefining sin itself within his own kingdom.
But the moment Bennett's actions went from secret to public defiance, that conditional morality just evaporated.
He was gone. He was excommunicated in June 1842. And he didn't just walk away. He claimed he was being hunted.
And that's where this story turns from moral flexibility to outright violence.
Yeah. Bennett leaves town immediately, but claims he's being stalked by alleged Danite operatives. And these are some big names, like Orrin Porter Rockwell.
Now, the Danites are often dismissed as this brief thing that only happened in Missouri.
Right, a historical footnote. But Bennett's claims suggest a very real continuous threat in Nauvoo. He said one of them, a Captain Parker, was ready for him or any other person having the same object in view.
Which means assassination.
It means assassination. And for you, the listener, this is so important. It shows the tangible fear and violence that was part of the Nauvoo power structure. If you cross the prophet, the penalty wasn't just losing your membership.
It could be your life.
It could be.
And Bennett's claims about this group are, I mean, they're bizarre. He called them the Daughters of Zion.
The details are wild, and you have to assume they were probably exaggerated for his expose. He claimed their oath involved seeing the prophet as the supreme god and agreeing to be thrown in a cauldron of boiling oil if you revealed secrets.
And the most unbelievable part?
The most unbelievable part was him claiming 12 Danites dressed in female apparel tried to assassinate him.
Dressed in female apparel? That sounds, I don't know, almost designed to ridicule them.
It does sound like that. But here's where we have to separate the potential exaggeration from the credible threat.
Okay.
While a historian like Fawn Brody was skeptical the Danites formally existed in Illinois, the details about gruesome death oaths and self-mutilation, they track uncomfortably well with some of the temple covenants being introduced at that same time.
So the core mechanism of the threat secrecy enforced by violence was very real.
It was. Even if Bennett embellished the fashion choices.
And the church's official line today tries to downplay all this.
Massively. They call the Danites a much embellished myth that was only around for 5 months in 1838.
But our sources say otherwise.
They directly contradict that. The Sangamon Journal reported on Danite activities all through the 1840s, including a murder over unpaid tithes. And that same newspaper referenced them 41 times during the Utah period.
So the idea of Mormon vigilantes was very much alive for decades.
It was far from a brief myth.
So given these very real threats, Bennett's public rhetoric after he escaped was just as inflammatory.
Oh, absolutely. He went on this extensive lecture circuit and just flooded the Midwest with hatred and suspicion towards Nauvoo.
He used some pretty strong language.
He urged citizens to put down this hydra-headed monster of Mormonism. I mean, invoking a hydra, a beast you have to destroy completely. That's a violent metaphor.
So he was directly contributing to the climate that led to Smith's murder.
He absolutely provided the fuel and, maybe more importantly, the institutional secrets that fed the mob mentality that killed Joseph Smith.
So Bennett moves on and becomes this, I guess, infamous ex-Mormon whistleblower. And the speed he did it with is just staggering.
He finished his entire expose in less than a month.
And the church's reaction
was a spectacular failure of prophecy. Joseph Smith publicly prophesied that Bennett and his book would fail financially.
And it didn't.
Not even close. Bennett lived off the proceeds from his book and lectures for 2 full years. He tapped into a huge public appetite for this kind of scandal.
And Smith's counteroffensive wasn't just a prophecy. It was a massive mobilization.
It was staggering. Smith sent over 300 elders, an entire mission's worth of people to go rebut Bennett's claims all across the East Coast.
Wow.
They would follow him, disrupt his lectures by speaking in tongues, yelling. The church poured an unprecedented amount of energy and money into fighting a PR war against one guy.
That level of response tells you how dangerous they thought he was.
Exactly. They found his revelations very, very credible.
But even after escaping Nauvoo, Bennett just couldn't escape his own patterns of behavior, could he?
Not at all. After Smith's death, he tried to jump right back into the world of competing prophets. He tried to insert himself into the succession crisis, claiming Smith had appointed Sidney Rigdon.
When that failed.
He joined James Strang's offshoot church in Michigan and immediately tried to get his old position back in the first presidency.
It's just, the historical irony is incredible. He flees Nauvoo for his behavior only to repeat it in the very next group he joins.
The exact same patterns. He was quickly expelled from Strang's church for, and I quote, false doctrine regarding polygamy and concubinage.
The same playbook.
Yeah.
And even there, we see hints of his passionate nature reemerging.
You do. His biographer noted that while with the Strangites, Bennett became unusually close to a Dr. Pierce Fagan. He sent him numerous intimate letters, insisted they start an office together. It really reinforces that idea.
So this man who survived being the number one enemy of this powerful religious movement, he eventually just retreats from the spotlight. What was his final legacy?
He died in 1865, and his later life took some truly bizarre turns. He published a book of poetry, he developed recipes for ketchup as medicine.
Ketchup as medicine.
Ketchup as medicine. And he got really into agriculture. He became famous for crossbreeding chickens. He's actually credited with creating the Plymouth Rock chicken.
That's incredible. But the smear campaign from the church, that didn't stop, did it?
No, it went on for years. As late as 1850, Brigham Young was falsely claiming that Bennett had died a gruesome death.
8 years after he was excommunicated.
8 years. It just shows the longevity of their willingness to perpetuate this false, violent narrative to neutralize him, even when he was no longer a threat. Meanwhile, he's buried next to his wife in Iowa under a huge tombstone.
His biographer calls him the man Mormons love to hate. And yet, I bet for most people listening, they've never even heard his name.
He was erased. He was erased because he knew too many of the institutional secrets.
His story really is a perfect case study.
It is. It shows how powerful organizations defend themselves, the sheer scale of the reaction to him, 300 missionaries, the death threats, the character assassination. It shows how early Mormon leadership protected itself at all costs.
He was, like we said, a deeply flawed opportunist.
A hypocrite.
Of the highest order. But the church used his personal flaws, his promiscuity, his same-sex relations, to deflect from its own systemic secrets.
Things like polygamy and power abuses just got swept under the rug of his personal scandal. Exactly.
And that really raises a specific question for you, the listener. If a system is willing to go to such extreme lengths, sending out an entire mission to counter one ex-member, creating narratives of gruesome death, and then basically burying the entire story, what does that tell you about the power and maybe the truth of what that man was speaking?
John C. Bennett proved that being a whistleblower in the 19th century could be a two-year, highly profitable profession. But when you look at the fate of other prominent figures who challenged Joseph Smith's authority, you have to wonder. You have to wonder if Bennett's intense focus on developing Plymouth Rock poultry and selling medicinal ketchup in his later life was less about finding a new passion and more about successfully ensuring he finally became too irrelevant and maybe just too absurd to kill.